Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. And I'm back in the dump studio after a wonderful whirlwind tour of Plainfield yesterday. Thanks to the staff at Plainfield Hardware for having me. Today, we'll meet a private investigator with great stories to tell, including how she wound up in the business. Calvin Cutler will provide a state house update. We'll learn how community well-being can be fostered through social media. At 10, delicious fudge, need I say more. And then we'll meet a Westburg firefighter who's collecting equipment to send to Ukraine. And then we'll finish with some haiku this morning. But first, let's meet our private investigator. Susan Randall is the owner of VT Private Eye and is here to talk about the work she does. Susan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much, Rick. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Listeners, to ask Susan about what it takes to be a private investigator, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Susan, before you became a private investigator, what had you been doing for a living?
So I had actually been down in New York City after I got out of college. I went down to New York and was working doing documentary film and kind of investigative reporting. And I did an internship with the McNeil Lehrer News Hour right after I got out of college. And then from that sort of led on to interviewing people. And I worked on the series Biography, which like an A&E television series, like basically looking at like mobsters and millionaires and doing like famous people's life stories for Biography.
And then what brought you from New York City to Vermont?
Well, you know, I actually, I kind of just hit the expiration date on living in Manhattan and kind of wanted to go for a mountain bike ride and go jump in a river and sort of tried to figure out how do you reinvent yourself with a basic skill set of interviewing people. And I actually first ended up going into VPR. I was a reporter at VPR for a little bit. You know, basically the same kind of skills as doing documentary film where you're interviewing people and getting information and then putting a story together. And so I worked kind of doing what you're doing for a couple of years, right when I first got here, sort of trying to figure out how to, you know, how to do that job of storytelling in Vermont. It's challenging.
Yeah. Well, yes, you definitely had the skill set to go from that to that. But then you decide at some point to become a private eye. So was there an aha moment that you said, I think I know where, you know, my real strengths lie?
Yeah, you know, actually, it was funny. There's a woman named Nancy Stevens who actually was the first female private investigator in Vermont that was non-law enforcement. And she was basically my way into doing this work. She was the justice of the peace for when I got married. And when I was working at VPR, they had given us this assignment. They said, you know, we're going to do an impact series, which is how, you know, people that are disabled or elderly are surviving winters in Vermont. And, you know, so I was like in my late 20s. I went marching out to go report on this case and basically reported on this case with somebody that was putting a wood stove in a, you know, into the back of a school bus. And he wanted to have a computer repair shop and drive the bus to Florida. And I went running out across this field to go get a soundbite from this guy and ended up with somebody confessing to this shooting that had happened that was unsolved. And so I did this radio story for VPR. And when I did this radio story and they aired the piece, all of a sudden Nancy called me and she said, oh, my gosh, you should have come work with me. I was like, Nancy, nobody's ever going to confess to a shooting again. But that kind of catapulted me into doing PI work. And then I kind of had to decide. At a certain point, I was still, I think I was reporting, you know, for VPR and also working as a PI, and then I realized I had, I think there was a big case at UVM. There was a legal case, and it was also a big radio story. And at that point, I was like, okay, I have to decide, am I going to be an NPR reporter, or am I actually going to be a private investigator and work behind the scenes? And, you know, at the time, I really wanted to have a family, and it's been a really amazing job just in terms of being able, I mean, it's intense, and it's a lot to juggle, but as far as being able to set your own schedule, and at that time, I had, and then I had a little baby, and so I was kind of like the, I was like the detective in Fargo for a little while there. I would have this big pregnant belly with my notebook on top. Yes, it's been an incredible journey. It's been about 23 years I've been doing it now.
Wow. And has anyone else confessed to you a murder in all that time?
You know, I've had some pretty intense confessions. I don't think anything like that has ever happened before. Mm-hmm. That one was kind of amazing because I had no expectation of working on anything criminal ever. I mean, some people become PIs because they're obsessed with, you know, they watch all the CSI shows and they're reading detective novels. And I never even thought of it. And so that one kind of blindsided me. I thought I was doing a story about a guy with degenerative back disorder who had a bunch of parrots in a trailer. And the next thing I knew, you know, I had this somebody confessing to a shooting. So, that was really a surprise. I have had, you know, I think the piece for me over the years is, you know, most people that get involved with the criminal justice system have just had really, really difficult lives and really difficult childhoods. And so, you know, you think it's going to be this sort of whodunit, and really what you end up doing is you have sort of a front row seat on poverty, on mental health, on addiction. Most people that end up, you know, I'm different than some PIs are doing insurance claims and a lot of surveillance. I do some of that, but I do mostly criminal defense work. So it's mostly trying to help out indigent Vermonters who have been charged with either state or federal crimes. And what you really find out is that, you know, people that didn't get what they needed when they were children end up in trouble later in life. And so it's just, I think for me, more than people confessing to a murder, I mostly have people opening up about what happened to them as children. I feel like abused children end up being incarcerated adults often. So it's been a lot more social work than I ever thought it would be. And just, you know, being a listening ear and telling a different story than the prosecutor's telling. Often, you know, you'll walk into a courtroom and, you know, the worst moment of somebody's life is being described in great detail. And what we try to do is sort of describe all the other moments. You know, who is this person and how did they end up where they ended up is really what my job has been for the last 20 plus years. And, it's been fascinating. I feel very privileged. I feel like I get this incredible front row seat on the human condition and on a lot of Vermonters' lives. And, you know, it really is a privilege. I feel like people tell me really their most intimate, vulnerable stories. And I try to retell them in court in a way that will generate some compassion and, you know, have the judges have to toss and turn a little before they hand out their sentence, you know.
Mm-hmm. So who tends to hire you for your services?
So for the most part, I would say we do about 75% criminal defense work. So it's kind of a combination of, you know, some conflict attorneys that work for the Defender General that, let's say, you know, there's a case where you have somebody has a state contract as a public defender, and they need an investigator to go look into, you know, speak to the witnesses, read the discovery, you know, figure out where's the surveillance footage. So that would be some public defender offices. And then I also get hired by private attorneys to work on private criminal cases or civil cases. You know, civil cases are where two people are suing each other. Criminal cases are where the state or the federal government is, you know, it's usually civil cases are where you're looking at money, and you know, criminal cases are where you're looking at jail time usually, or some kind of a punishment. So I do a lot of work on what's called the CJA panel, which is the Criminal Justice Administration. There's a panel of federal defense attorneys who are experienced attorneys that represent indigent clients that are accused of federal crimes. And so that's sort of the bulk of my work. And then I also do, you know, individuals, private individuals will often call me and, you know, it's interesting with the upswing of internet dating, how many calls I get where it's like,
really?
Does this guy really have a ranch in Texas? it'll be like the family members calling saying, look, we want to find out, you know, Maggie's dating this guy she met online. We don't know if he's for real or if he's all of it. So I get some of that stuff. And we do a lot of, I actually have some young interns and some young investigators that help a lot with social media checks. And there's some due diligence that, as an investigator, I think in 2022, you kind of can't ignore everything that everybody posts about themselves online. You kind of have to really look into that. So I've really utilized some younger members of our team. So they've been really helpful. So we do, you know, background checks. We'll do due diligence for employers, some civil work where we do witness interviews to see, you know, what people are going to say. And then I actually dovetail a lot of my work as a documentary filmmaker. We also produce settlement videos. Often when people have been injured, we may do a day in the life video. You know, if somebody was in a terrible car accident and there's some kind of a settlement, often we'll go and film what their life is like now just to show, you know, the adjusters or the other side, look, this is what this person's up against. And we also do what we call mitigation sentencing videos. So that's usually, let's say there's a defendant that's looking at, you know, a 20-year sentence, and they've had, a extremely difficult life, or what we call mitigating factors. Let's say there's things that, you know, they were handed a really difficult deck. We may do a video about their life, similar to what I did at Biography, actually.
Instead
of doing famous people, we're doing, like, people that are in trouble that need a compassionate narrative told in a visual way, so that we use a lot of visual advocacy in the court, which has been really fun for me because it kind of combines what I used to do. So instead of, like, the Nielsen ratings at A&E Television, they're actually looking for a downward departure for somebody who may get 20 years, you may be able to get them, you know, a huge victory of like 8 years. You know? Like sometimes you wonder, but.
Let's take a break. Susan, we're going to take a break quickly. Let's go to Newbury. We got Fred on the line. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Hey, you know, it's really interesting. I agree with you about criminality being an education problem. And I sort of can prove it by this, and that is, why, if you're going to be a criminal, why would you want to use a cell phone in social media? It is the dumbest thing you could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
What say you?
Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that. I'm always shocked how much information people actually put out on the internet about themselves, not really thinking that it's available for everybody, for whatever their end goal is. And you'd be amazed. I mean, law enforcement on a regular basis will pull everybody's Facebook page, their Instagram. I mean, there's evidence. People have been, I mean, around the country, you see it all the time when you go to these investigator trainings, that people get charged by what appears. I mean, I'm stunned. So, yeah, if you don't take anything else away from listening to this radio show, be mindful of what you're throwing up there online about yourself. It's a really good point. I appreciate you calling in, Fred.
Has that made it easier for you as a private investigator, Susan?
You know, what does make easier, I mean, for instance, today, you know, I'm working on a really big case, and I'm having to travel across three states to interview witnesses. And, you know, if I'm trying to figure out is somebody, you know, if somebody's not at their house, where are they working? Often people upload photos, mm-hmm. just got a new job, working at Pizza Hut, and they got a picture of themselves. Or, you know, I'm going to be at my brother's camp for the weekend. So if I'm trying to locate a witness, honestly, I often will do a last-minute peruse of the social media to see where they are.
Wow.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, even just to get a sense of if somebody has a really strong opinion about something and it might not be fair for a defendant to have them on a jury, sometimes it's almost ineffective assistance of counsel to not check out what people are posting online. So let's say you've got a very volatile political case, and somebody's got very, very strong opinions on one side or the other. You know, you may want to at least let the legal team know, hey, you know, juror number four feels really strongly about this. And so, yeah, I think it's, like I said, I think it's almost ineffective assistance of counsel to not do a really thorough search of social media before you, you know, go out to interview people or before you work on a case. And I'm part of this organization, the Vermont Association of Investigators, and next month we're actually finally reconvening after a big break from COVID. Mm-hmm. But one of our big topics is going to be social media investigations and how, you know, some of these older investigators, it's tough for us, you know. We're like, the old gumshoes are going to have to learn some new tricks. And, you know, it's great. It's a really nice, if you play it right, you know, the 20-somethings have an enormous amount to teach us. Yeah. And if we can, you know, impart some knowledge to them from 20 years of hitting the pavement, it's great. It can be a great coupling if both sides have enough respect to hear the other one out, you know.
Yeah, great exchange of ideas. Have you been keeping notes or a journal for that time that you decide to start writing the Samantha D. Champlain mysteries or whomever would be your heroine?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Every time I talk to somebody about this, I think I'm going to start to get better about keeping notes. you know, it's interesting. My friend Erica Heilman that does a podcast called Rumble Strip, she periodically will interview me about, hey, Susan, what's been going on? What are you thinking about these days? And to be honest with you, it's kind of this, it's almost like I have an audio journal because Erica's been so great about checking in every year or so. I'll do an interview with her and it kind of sums up like, this is what I'm thinking about this month. This is what happened this year. But I think, you know, I think actually my case files and a lot of the witness interview memos that I write in a weird way have kind of chronicled what I've done over the last bunch of years. Mm-hmm. I do tend to use the voice memo recording. So let's say it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm driving home through a snowstorm. My hands are at 10 and 2. You know, and I've got some great thought. I might pull over on the side of the road and dictate an email to myself. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and then I'll put in the headers like chapter 3, you know, like it was a dark and stormy night. It was a gray sky. The hawk was flying. The wind chimes were chiming, you know. But who knows? I think, you know, Nancy used to say to me, she said, you know, all investigators are just frustrated fiction writers. That's really all we are, you know. We're just waiting for our big moment to kick back in a lounge chair and dictate a novel. Who knows?
I can't wait. You recently gave a talk to students at St. Michael's College. So why were you invited there?
You know, it's interesting. There's such a move right now into STEM, and so many college campuses are telling a lot of young people, you know, if you don't go into science and technology, you're never going to get a job. And, you know, the soft science, you know, at UVM, arts and sciences has been really slashed with a push towards STEM. And my job in particular, I use the soft sciences all the time. Sociology, economics, race, gender, politics, it all becomes relevant. And I think St. Mike's recently started a criminology department, which was sort of a subset of sociology. UVM's had it for a while. And it's where we get a lot of our interns that help us on these cases where we don't have big budgets. The interns get experience in exchange for, you know, some help getting records or summarizing jail calls or looking at Exxon videos from, you know, Discovery. We get their help and then we give them something that they, you know, they get a front row seat. So St. Mike's, I had a good friend of mine who works at St. Mike's who said, oh, Susan, you know, they're starting this criminology department. Would you be willing to come speak to one of the classes? They invited me over to just give a talk, and I actually showed a sentencing video to kind of give them a sense of like what we do. And it was really sweet. At the end of the talk, there was a big long line of students who wanted you know, who were interested in, I'm actually taking an intern next fall from St. Mike's as a result.
Love it.
Which is great.
Well, we've got about a minute and a half left, and I'm wondering what type of person would do well in the business you're in as private investigator.
You know, you have to be compassionate. You have to really love people. You have to not judge, and you got to have a level of humility. And on some level, you have to be enough of a mess up yourself that you feel a lot of compassion for people that aren't perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, and be a good listener and attention to detail, be able to multitask, have everything in pencil. You know, you think your day is going to go a certain way and then the phone rings and you're off on another adventure. So, but the big thing is just compassion and realizing that we're all connected. And, you know, when you see people that get in trouble, keep in mind it's a yet. You know, I like to say it's a yet. You're eligible too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Any of us, given the right set of circumstances, could end up in trouble. And
yeah.
So try to have compassion when you don't necessarily know what the backstory was. So that's the biggest thing. When I interview people to work with me, I just say, you got to have a huge heart to do this work. And got to be tough.
Yeah. Boy, we don't really think of compassion as being one of those elements, but that's a great takeaway. Susan Randall is the owner of VT Private Eye. You can learn more about the work that they do at vtprivateeye.com. Susan, it was great having you on the show this morning. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, and thanks for all you're doing, and take care.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll return to get a State House update from Calvin Cutler of WCAX. And coming up today at 12:10, we start our coverage of the Sox Game 2 in Detroit against the Tigers, favorite team of former Burlington Mayor Peter Clavel. First pitch with Joe Castiglione and crew is at 1:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it's time to turn our attention to Montpelier, get an idea of what's going on under the Golden Dome. Here to provide a State House update is WCAX's Capital Bureau Chief Calvin Cutler. Calvin, great to have you back on with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Calvin, how close are we to the end of the session?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we are just a few weeks away. The top lawmakers, they're hoping to adjourn by May 6th is the day that everybody is looking to. And so there's just a few weeks left. And really, I mean, this is crunch time for a lot of bills, for a lot of policies, and especially the budget. You know, we've talked how largely, you know, the governor and, you know, the House and Senate are on the same page priority-wise, but there's still some significant disagreements, especially over tax policy, you know, how best to provide tax relief to Vermonters, and also the House and Senate, they have some differences on, you know, workforce and economic development packages as well. So I think there's definitely a lot of work that needs to happen before the end of the session. But, you know, this dynamic way of, I guess, you know, finishing the session,
yeah,
it's not uncommon.
True. 4 weeks to go, and this is when it really the pedal hits the metal, the rubber meets the road, and things start to get really worked out. And has some sense of normalcy returned to the State House after, you know, the pandemic has, you know, seems to have pretty much abated?
Right. I mean, I would say so. You know, everybody's been doing work online through Zoom, remote lawmaking, for the past 2 years. And now if you go to the State House, there's, you know, lobbyists, journalists, lawmakers, school groups, it's really coming back alive. So I think there is definitely some sort of normalcy that is coming back to the process, and especially having that in-person lawmaking and you know, deliberations is really critical.
Good to hear. The Senate is reviewing House Bill 728. What is this, and why has it garnered the Senate's attention?
Yeah, so this passed the House, a few weeks ago, and lawmakers in the Senate are looking at it. And really, it stems off of some of the really concerning numbers of overdose deaths that we saw in 2021. We learned last week that there were 210 overdose deaths, really driven by two things, the pandemic and the subsequent isolation, and also the deadly synthetic opioid. Synthetic opioid fentanyl. So essentially this bill would, expand services to overdose response, mobile medication treatment for methadone. And, I think the biggest one with this one, it would also, create a task force that would look into the potential for safe consumption sites. Some people, they're also known as safe injection sites, where people can consume drugs under medical supervision. And if somebody were to overdose, they'd be able to administer Narcan. So these, I think, are it's a controversial debate, and people have strong feelings about these sites on both sides, and it's a very gritty and nuanced and complex discussion. So we're going to begin to, should this bill go through, it's unclear how the governor feels about it, but this is going to be the start of a very interesting conversation this coming summer.
Calvin, we discussed the universal school meals bill last week. Where does that stand? Any idea of how it would be funded? And what are the governor's thoughts on it?
Yeah, so this is the one that was been funded by federal aid all throughout the pandemic, but that expires on June 1st. So the state wants to set up its own. Lawmakers were looking into, taxes on candy or soda or a cloud tax, but last Tuesday, we heard emphatically from Governor Scott that, he does not want any new taxes, especially, given the surplus we have and really the inflation that a lot of Vermonters are feeling right now. So last week, the House Education Committee voted to extend the meals for 1 year, being funded with about $29 million in surplus education funding. And again, this would also set up a summer task force to looking into a permanent revenue source, being very cognizant of the governor's concerns of raising taxes, but also, trying to be creative. And where can we find, $27, $28, $29 million to fund this year over year?
Mm-hmm. Now, keeping with education, pupil waiting was something that was mentioned a lot in the off season. Give us a quick primer, first of all, of what pupil waiting is.
Right. So pupil waiting, essentially, it's the education funding formula that takes into account, how low income and rural and English language learning students, how they are funded and, what it means for the property tax rate. And without getting too far down the rabbit hole, there was a UVM study that came out a couple of years ago that showed that the current funding system is inequitable. And under the prior Supreme Court ruling, funding has to be equitable and kids have to receive the same quality of education. So lawmakers have really been kind of puzzling with how can we reform the school funding formula and these so-called pupil weights. And, there's been a lot of work, just like with some of the pension task force discussions. There's been a lot of work that's gone into the pupil task force as well. They met last year all throughout the summer and through this legislative session too, to come up with recommendations. And I think right now there's two big ones that are on the front burner. That's, categorical aid or direct grants for students in districts that are English language learners, because those would be direct grants. And then there's also this new cost equity proposal as well that essentially sets exact dollar amounts for certain students instead of allowing communities to make local spending decisions based on taxing capacity. So these are pretty complex pretty complex proposals, and I think there's a lot that lawmakers and advocates are still having to unpack, but there definitely is, I'm hearing some concern from, equity or education equity advocates of, what especially the cost equity proposal could mean. Mm-hmm. So I think, we're going to have to dig into this, and the conversation is still very much, very, very alive, so to speak.
You mentioned the Supreme Court, Vermont Supreme Court, getting a new justice. What can you tell us about her and her judicial philosophy?
Exactly. This Friday, Judge Nancy Waples, she's going to be sworn in to succeed Supreme Court Justice Beth Robinson on the state's high court. You know, Waples, she was an assistant U.S. attorney for Vermont in Lamoille County since about 2015, I believe. And, you know, you're right. You know, this judicial philosophy that she has, she told the Senate Judiciary Committee when they were going through her confirmation process that she looks to achieve consensus and that, you know, if confirmed, she'd bring a different perspective to the bench with a lived experience. You know, she comes from a lineage of Chinese immigrants, and her family was from China. And so she says she brings that different perspective when it comes to, you know, what she would bring to, you know, ruling on a Supreme Court case. And also, you know, this Friday, when she's sworn in, she'll be the first woman of color on the high court as well. So it's a pretty significant, you know, step forward in terms of representation on the state Supreme Court. And of course, there's also, you know, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson on the U.S. Supreme Court as well. So there's definitely a lot of Supreme Court in the news nowadays.
Got about a minute left. Let's squeeze in a little politics because this is a big political year. What do we know about the fundraising in the race to replace Senator Patrick Leahy between the presumptive favorites, Democrat Peter Welch and Republican Christina Nolan?
Right. This Friday is the quarterly April congressional filing deadline for campaigns. It really gives us a sense of how much support the candidates are getting. You know, we learned last week that former U.S. Attorney Christina Nolan, running as a Republican, she's raised about $156,000. Peter Welch, he's going to be filing later this week, but he's raised about $550,000 as well, in addition to about $2 million he had in his campaign account. So, you know, fundraising and campaign cash, that's just one way to measure support.
And then very quickly, to replace Welch, on the Democratic side, Becca Ballant, Molly Gray, Keisha Ram Hinsdale, who has the lead there in raising cash?
Last we heard, Molly Gray was leading with about $300,000. Becca Ballant, she was, you know, had about $200,000. Keisha Ram Hinsdale and Shanae Chase Clifford, they didn't have to file because they weren't in the race at that point. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what kinds of support they've gotten, what sort of geographic support in state, out of state, what corners of the state, what types of businesses. You know, it's really fascinating to read over some of those numbers.
Fantastic. Someone had sent me a link about cheese curds that was on a Facebook page. On this specific Facebook page, and I had to know more about the page, and so I reached out to Trish Sears, who is here to tell us all about it. Trish, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for inviting us.
Now, Trish, what exactly is this Facebook page that's been created called hashtag We Are Lowell J, Westfield Troy Area Strong?
It started, you know, right at the beginning of, so March 2020, when COVID started closing us down. Mm-hmm. And so it was very informal as far as, you know, reaching out and touching people we knew. So there was, you know, people from Jay, again, Westfield. And eventually we brought in Troy, and we just wanted to make sure that the communication regarding, you know, COVID testing, COVID treatment, COVID information, that kind of thing was, you know, getting directed to our local areas, because certainly in the Northeast Kingdom, you know, where we're even more remote rural, our part of the kingdom, you know, is also, you know, we're about 30 minutes away from Newport. So, you know, we don't always get what we need here. It's, you know, usually focused in Newport.
Trish, social media has its detractors. So how do you see digital engagement contributing to a community's well-being rather than taking away from it?
Well, it's definitely, it's like any communication or engagement, you know, conversations that you would have, whether it would be, you know, town meeting day or whatever, there are things that people are not going to agree with. Yeah. Or people that, you know, want to contribute, you know, you need to know about this. So in the beginning, we were, you know, we had recruited a network that included people who were connectors in their community, especially connectors to the fire department and the ambulances and, you know, other health kind of things. And that really helped us mobilize as a group to, you know, find out where there was food shortage or just getting the word out, you know, to those communities, since we're contiguous, you know, with each other as far as remote rural and Newport Town and over the mountain, Irisburg, you know, they're a different segment as far as geographically. And we have had, you know, conversations about, you know, online in the group, especially about face masks and, you know, was, you know, is this good, bad, or indifferent, you know, and imposing on my rights and all that kind of thing. So there's been some healthy conversation there. And then, you know, we have, as other groups have evolved and we learned from other groups, is we have group rules for that particular Facebook page, which includes, you know, just being kind and not using, you know, bad language or incendiary, you know, kind of comments.
Well done. Now, Trish, 2 years into it, how do you keep it authentic, engaging, useful, relevant? How do you do those things?
Well, we have the majority of the postings are shared by Peggy Lux in Jay and myself in, you know, I sit in Lowell. And basically, we have different areas, if you will, as far as, you know, being able to cross-share and information for our group. So I tend to pick up stories from Vermont Digger, VPR, you know, other statewide or even local like Caledonia Record, information and stories that, you know, are, you know, have a relevance to our communities. And then Peggy, you know, is really keyed into local businesses and, you know, restaurants and that kind of thing. So, you know, different restaurant specials are put up. So we've become a place, a real place, if you will, for, we now have like over 800 people, for people to get information.
Yeah, it's almost like the old community bulletin board, but it's virtual and it's updated all the time. So over the 2 years, has there been anything that has really stood out that has been the most interesting or funny or strange thing that has been posted on the page?
Well, you know, it's been a learning experience. You know, we have discovered new businesses or new to us businesses. And so, you know, the way they promote themselves or, you know, that kind of thing can, you know, is certainly useful and on occasion amusing. And then we also established, you know, we learned from working with Vermont Council on Rural Development. I participated in a lot of the webinars, especially in the beginning of COVID pandemic. So learning how to set up a warm line. So we wanted to make sure we were not a hotline. We were not equipped for that. Mm-hmm. So we started a Google number, and that's still relevant now. We just got a call not too long ago from someone who was just really feeling sad and, you know, just needed to know where to call or where to go. Yeah. So we have that kind of list, if you will, and connections. And then, you know, in the beginning it was, I don't know, I don't have transportation. I don't, you know, I don't have enough food and that kind of thing. So working with different partners like Northeast Kingdom Human Services, Northeast Kingdom Community Action, and the schools and others was, you know, we participated in different meetings with those groups. And then we also interviewed, the Orleans County Sheriff, again, the heads of those organizations that I mentioned, Umbrella, which is, you know, domestic violence resource and that kind of thing. So we nourish those connections and bring them, you know, more focus where they're, you know, in somebody's Facebook feed, they may get lost or they don't see them. But here, again, going to your point, it's a community bulletin board, but it really is a place. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you belong here. And so people share what we share and they share it to, you know, either their own groups or their own personal feed and that kind of thing.
Yep. Trish Sears is the co-founder, president, and CEO of NEKTI Consulting. And she loves the kingdom as much as anyone on this earth. Trish, thanks so much for being on with us. Right?
You're most welcome, Rick. Have a wonderful day. Take care.
Take care, Trish. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to be back to meet one of the creators of some amazing goat's milk fudge. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Come on, Vermont. You're killing me. I need one more delicious thing to be obsessed about here. Not sure how I find all that is magnificent in Vermont or how it finds me, but it happens. The latest are the creations of Buster and Bella's, and I'm going to try not to eat any of it during this show. With me is one of the owners of Buster and Bella's, John Restivo. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. And John, what I've done is I have the fudge a full level below me. It's downstairs. I can't get to it during the show, so I think I'll be safe. Listeners, to ask John about the fudge and the other things they make, or to let us know if you've already imbibed, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Now, John, the name is actually Buster and Bella's specialty company, so it's more than just fudge. I don't want to slight anything, so tell us about all the things you're making there at your farm in Londonderry.
Sure. So right now, principally, we are making the fudge. We also offer honey that we gather from our beehives on the farm. And we have a lot of ideas of different products that we're looking forward to making in the future. We've got ideas for toffees and all sorts of different goat milk products, tonics, elixirs, things like that. So, so that's why we wanted to keep it broad with the name.
Gotcha. And this isn't where you started. Where did Buster and Bella's begin?
So we began in Rhode Island about 10 years ago. We started a company out there called Legends Creek Farm that was a goat milk personal care products business. We've always wanted to make food and different kinds of food products, but we started with goat milk soaps and lotions and skin salves and things like that. And eventually we had to sell that company, and we moved up to Vermont, very happy that we did. And we started Buster and Bella's a little over a year ago and with a focus on the food products.
We're happy to have you. Why did you decide that Vermont was the place, John?
So there was a lot of different factors. When COVID hit with Legends Creek Farm, we had a real explosion of growth, and it came at the same time that we were running into some regulatory issues in Rhode Island that were preventing us from expanding. And so we had to sell that company just a few months into COVID. And at the same time, I started working remotely. I'm an attorney, and I started going full-time remote. So that kind of opened up the opportunity for us to just sort of choose where we wanted to live. And Vermont, for a lot of different reasons, was always a place that I think a lot of people dream of living, dream of moving to. And so the opportunity came. We found a beautiful property, and we decided to make the move, and we're very happy we did.
Well, we're happy to have you. We need to know, though, who are Buster and Bella?
So Buster and Bella are our two dogs, our two Australian shepherds. Legends Creek was named after our dog Legend, and so we thought it only appropriate to name our new company after our other two dogs, Buster and Bella. And we're glad we did. They are beautiful dogs, very happy, certainly keep us motivated, it's a lot of fun.
If you adopt more dogs, you're going to have to keep forming new companies. Is that the idea, John?
That's it. Yep. We'll keep it going.
Well done. Now, I've watched the videos of your fudge being blended. I just want to jump in that big bowl and take my chances with those mixer blades. But explain the process of making fudge.
Sure. So it involves kind of a combination of both sugar work and chocolate work. It is, primarily sugar-based. And so it's a matter of sort of heating it to the right temperature, making sure the consistency is correct, then cooling it rapidly while stirring it. And, of course, the ingredients make a big difference as well in the final product. And believe me, I share that sentiment with you. I love the fudge myself, and I thought that I'd be getting sick of it after having pounds and pounds of it all around me. But
right.
We're very proud of the product that we've been making. It's delicious, and I hope you've been able to enjoy it as well.
I have. As a matter of fact, I feel like I have turned the corner and really have become a Vermonter, because after testing your different flavors, I go, the maple walnut is the one that hits me, right? It's like, before, I enjoyed maple, but now it's like, ooh, maple. It is so ingrained here in Vermont. When you smell it boiling, when you taste it in anything, you just get pretty excited about it. But what are the other flavors that you're making right now?
So we have our chocolate walnut. We have our peanut butter fudge. We have a strawberry shortcake. We have white chocolate. We have a chai tea flavor. And we have a lot of flavors that we're planning coming out with. So right now we're working on a Black Forest cake-inspired fudge with chocolate and cherries that we're getting ready for Mother's Day. Spicy peanut and pretzel fudge that we're getting ready for Father's Day. And that's been a lot of the fun of this, is really coming up with these new flavors and testing them and seeing what we can create.
Yeah. How do you decide, to develop and, if somebody throws out an idea, between you and Aiden, do you just say, okay, let's try it? Or if one of you turns up the nose and says, I don't think so, do you just say, all right, let's try something else?
Well, Aiden and I are fairly different, both in our tastes and the way we approach things. And so the way that we usually know that we've landed on something that's going to be successful is when we both like it.
Gotcha.
And so, if we both get excited about it, that's when we know that we finally hit the jackpot. And so that's generally the way we approach it. There's veto power over everything on each side.
And you use goat's milk. So why is goat's milk the proper ingredient for great fudge?
So the goat's milk really came to us as opposed to us seeking it out. When we first started, back in Rhode Island 10 years ago, we started raising goats, and we just loved it. We absolutely we really enjoyed their personalities and thought they were a lot of fun to raise. And so we started using the goat's milk and the soaps and personal care products, and we just kind of continued that. We came up to Vermont, and so it does give a not so prominent flavor to the fudge, but we've certainly heard from people who have an easier time digesting goat's milk compared to cow's milk. There are some people who do pick up a subtle flavor from the goat's milk in the fudge itself, and it's just, you know, we find it to be a great product to work with.
How many goats do you have there at the farm in Londonderry?
So right now we just have a dozen. We don't actually milk our goats on the farm for the goat's milk. We don't have the dairy license to do that yet, but we do get all of our milk from a Vermont goat farm. And that's the goal one day, is to grow and become a full-functioning dairy here as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned it, and I've heard from other people who do, you know, goat's milk in their soaps, et cetera, the personalities of goats that people love so much. Tell us about that, because I'm not around goats on a daily basis like you. What do you love so much about their personalities?
They just, you know, we've had cows before, we've had sheep before, certainly raised all sorts of birds, but goats, they know their name, they all have different personalities, they, you know, have different tastes, likes, dislikes. Something about watching them play with each other, jumping up on rocks and, you know, chasing each other around the yard, they're just a lot of fun.
They almost pirouette sometimes when they jump, don't they? Or, you know, have like a ballet type hop to them when they're out there playing.
Yeah, they do. And they, you know, they're very smart. They're very intelligent creatures. And sometimes that works against you. You know, sometimes they like to escape and they like to get into all sorts of trouble. But after years of raising them, we've kind of learned how to work with them and the personalities in a way that is a lot of fun.
John, I don't want to obsess about the goats, but I just have one more question. Do the goats have any idea what deliciousness they're contributing to?
Well, you know, they certainly have a nice, easy life. They're rewarded for everything that they do contribute. They I'm sure they would prefer to be eating grass and weeds, though, as opposed to the fudge.
Point well taken. Now, tell us about your farm there in Londonderry.
So it's a beautiful, beautiful property. It was, I think, like a lot of properties, certainly in Vermont, it was previously used as, when I say previously, I mean in the 1800s as a sheep farm for wool. So there are beautiful old stone walls that had all sort of gotten grown in, and we've been sort of working on opening it up and looking forward to actually planting some different herbs to go in those tonics and elixirs that I'd mentioned, and planting a nice little orchard and growing all sorts of different fruits and vegetables and things like that.
Yeah, and sometimes people forget that long before we were a dairy state, Vermont was a wool-producing state, and we had sheep just about everywhere, cleared a lot of the land at that time back in the 1800s. I think our forest dropped about 30% of the land. And Londonderry is such a wonderful place to be, John. Now, I'm always thinking about food. You're close to Solo, farm to table there. You're close to Honey Pie and probably a lot of great restaurants. But tell us about the Londonderry area.
Well, so you're absolutely right. There are a number of excellent restaurants and specialty stores in the area. You know, what we found moving here is also just the kindness of the people. The first store that we were that started carrying our products was owned by one of the first friends who reached out to us when we first moved here to introduce herself and, you know, before she knew anything about us or what our plans were. The local grocery store and the general store were all extremely happy to help and to get our products in there. That's been, I think, one of the greatest things about this area that we found. And And the natural beauty is absolutely incredible. You know, the between the mountains and the rivers, we've got beautiful streams surrounding us. It's been one of the really great, exciting things about moving here, just exploring the area and sort of uncovering what it has to offer little by little.
As far as outdoors, do either of you ski or ride or hike, kayak? What do you do that you like being in the area?
So I do ski. I hadn't skied for quite a while because Aiden doesn't. And I got my season pass to Magic Mountain and got out there for the first time in years at the beginning of the season. And I loved it. I loved the mountain and it was great. And we both do hike. We love either hiking around the property or down in the area. We ride our bikes on the West River Trail, which is a beautiful feature of the area. We're looking forward to getting back into a lot of that as the weather gets warmer.
John, you mentioned you're a lawyer. So how farm work and fudge making, has this been something you've always wanted to do in addition to lawyering?
It is. It's definitely, Aiden does the vast majority of the work on Buster and Bella's on a day-to-day basis. For me, the farming doesn't feel so much like work when it breaks up kind of the law work. And it's a beautiful contrast to be able to kind of focus your energy in such different places. It helps, I think, in both respects.
And so we've been talking about Aiden. That's your husband, Aiden Mott, who runs the farm there at Buster and Bella's. How do you, decide who's responsible for what part of the operation?
So Aiden went to agricultural high school. He went to Norfolk Abbey in Walpole in Massachusetts. Oh. And so he sort of naturally took to a lot of the animal caretaking. He's excellent at just growing things when it comes to growing, different vegetables and stuff and cut flowers and things like that. If I look at a plant or if I even give him a recommendation, if I say, oh, that looks like it needs more water, try watering it and it'll die immediately. So he has natural talents when it comes to those sorts of things. And, I try to contribute more on, I'm a writer, for instance, so I'll write the content for the website, different things like that. And like I said, when it comes to the products themselves, as far as the flavors and what works and what doesn't, we both contribute and we know what works based on our agreements there.
Yeah, well, the website is beautifully done, and it is well written. So let's give people the website address. It's busterandbellas.com. John will give you a nod for the work you're doing there, which is really beautiful stuff. We mentioned before, the process is just so beautiful to see that fudge, being processed, being created. How do you stop yourselves from just eating so much fudge that you just have all that you can possibly consume and not even send any out? This would be a very difficult task for me.
Well, it is, we certainly have our favorites. We'll keep ourselves limited there. But there's always a little excess that comes with each batch that we make. And whether we're giving it out to neighbors and friends or, keeping it around, it's just all about self-control and moderation, but it gives us a lot of joy to be sharing it with people as well. We get a lot of very positive feedback from people that purchase it. So that's certainly part of it also.
John, we talked about the flavors that you've worked on and in developing them. Are there any that you tried that just didn't work out? You thought, this will be great, and you and Aiden said, one thing we can agree on is this will not see the light of day.
Well, we've been struggling recently with trying to make a sugar-free fudge. Uh-huh. That's one of our mail carriers is diabetic and keeps encouraging us to come out with something that low glycemic index And so that's been our latest struggle. We think we've found something that is going to work there. So stay tuned. That's definitely been one of our recent challenges.
Oh, good for you. And that's a great challenge. But if you overcome it and find the key to it, wow, it just opens up just a whole market for you, but also for those who can't have sugar. It would be a great way for them to enjoy. Where have customers ordered your goodies from so far?
So we've had a lot of success through the website. We advertise really nationwide, and we ship nationwide as well. We've certainly been introduced to a number of stores throughout Vermont and a few stores in neighboring states as well for brick and mortar sales. But lately, really overwhelmingly, it's all been website orders and shipping throughout the country.
Well, no lie, every time I've gone to your website, it's one of those that tells you when someone somewhere in the country or the world has ordered. And I think every time I've gone, someone has ordered in the last 20 minutes. So it sounds like it certainly has been pretty robust so far.
Yes. Yeah, it's been growing very fast. And, you know, we've really credited a lot of that that fast growth to the association that I think a lot of people everywhere kind of have with Vermont. And we've put that very prominent in our website and our marketing, because I think a lot of people do have such great positive associations with the state that they're willing to try something that they haven't tried before just because of those associations.
Are you doing your own fulfillment? It's beautifully boxed. Are you boxing it up and shipping it out yourselves?
We are, yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the packaging, because we actually, that was a huge challenge we had early on, was trying to find, we had a strong interest from our personal care products business in reducing the amount of plastics that we were using. And so one of the biggest challenges we had early on was finding a package that didn't have plastic, that was still sturdy enough to ship the product in. And so that was definitely something we had to overcome early on.
Have they gotten to know you well there at the local post office?
They have, yep. Yep, we've been keeping them busy.
How often are you in there shipping the fudge out?
So we have daily pickups. Our local carrier doesn't come to get them. She doesn't like to pick up packages from the property, but the postmaster will come, and other members of the office will come, and they pick up bags and bags of packages. It's been every day now.
Do they get a free sample when they come on out?
Not every day, but okay. We do, certainly for the holidays, and we love sharing with them. We've had some really, they've been really great.
That's fantastic. Plus, you get good feedback from someone other than you and Aiden, so that's a great help. John Restivo is one of the owners of Buster and Bella's Specialty Company in Londonderry. And to check out the goodness they're creating there, you can visit busterandbellas.com. John, thanks for the sweetness that you and Aiden are spreading, and thanks for being on the show this morning.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll come back to talk with West Burke volunteer firefighter Taylor Payton about what he's doing for Ukraine. And coming up today at 5:30, we've got the Brady Farkas Show, then Jazz with George Thomas at 7. And at 9 o'clock tonight, you can listen to Eye on the World with John Batchelor. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Some people, Some people see a problem and immediately think how they can use their talents and connections to make sure that we're doing the most we can for those in trouble. Take Ukraine. Our next guest looked at the situation there and knew he had to rally firefighters and Vermonters to help his brothers in arms in that country as they operate under the siege of Russian attacks. Taylor Payton is a volunteer fireman for the Westburg Fire Department, and he joins us now to discuss the efforts he has launched to help Ukraine. Taylor, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
How's it going?
It's going great. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Taylor how you can help, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Taylor, when and why did you become a firefighter?
It was actually after 9/11. I'm originally from California. I moved here. My stepmom was from here, and my parents moved out after I graduated high school. And 9/11 happened. I felt a calling to, volunteer with my local department. And being in Vermont, I was living in Lunenburg, and there wasn't a whole lot going on in Lunenburg
right.
for a young firefighter. So I kind of hightailed it back to California and pursued it a little more. And then I was 22, 23 when I joined the Fire Academy in Northern California, spent a couple of years as a paid volunteer, and then got frustrated with the politics in California and ended up in Vermont again. So it had been about 15 years since I was on a station, and I just recently, within the last year, felt the need to kind of give back to my community and get back into something that I enjoyed.
When you were in California, have you ever had to fight those massive forest fires?
Every summer.
No, boy.
Every summer, fall, spring. Yeah, it was a pretty much a yearly event. You know, the grass grows out there pretty fast and high and then dies and creates a lot of fuel.
And how difficult and different is that from fighting a house fire?
Night and day.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely different. It's a different ballpark, honestly. You have in a structure fire, it's visibility first off is zero. So you're doing everything blind. You're relying on your training and everything. And you're doing that in wildland too, or forest fire and forestry service. But it's a little more visible. You can see a lot of the action going on. You can see where the fire's at and what needs to happen. So but two different ballparks for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what drew you back to firefighting here in Westburg?
I see how my town has been growing. Being right next to East Burke and Burke Mountain, the biking system has kind of bled into the West Burke area, and our town's trying to, pick itself up a little bit and revitalize, and that really interested me, and I wanted to help out in that effort, and I missed being in that brotherhood of the fire department and the adrenaline you get from going to a call or responding to a call.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us what you're attempting to do to help the fighter fires in Ukraine.
Well, we have reached out. West Burke Fire Department has reached out to all the mutual aids within the surrounding areas, and in process of doing that still, actually. But we have been asking other departments if they have donatable gear, gear that's not being used or that might be recently out of date, but it's still in great condition. That we don't need, that we would either junk or get rid of. So in watching all the news and seeing these firefighters are nonstop, day in, day out, and they're putting their gear and their bunker gear, their turnouts, the pants and jackets, hats, boots that they wear every day, they're putting those things through the gauntlet, and I'm sure they're wearing down. We use our turnouts, you know, a handful of times a month, and these guys are doing it every single day.
Mm.
So they need equipment, they need help, they need, you know, food, they need a lot of stuff over there, and I felt that we could do that. And, you know, I asked if it was possible, if we had anything to donate, and checked with a couple other stations, and they had stuff that they would be willing to give out. And then the daunting task of trying to figure out how to get it there.
Yeah. Well, what kind of things have you received so far, and from whom, Taylor?
So we have gotten our sister department, East Burke, Lindenville Fire Department, Danville Fire Department. We've reached out to Newport and several of our surrounding area departments. And they're gathering pants, jackets, boots, helmets, tools, gloves, anything that you know, we don't need that we can give to them. So they're looking for, off of the firefighter gear, they're looking for tourniquets. They're looking for meals ready to eat, sort of like military food or camping food that you just add hot water to, non-perishable, dry, lightweight, and individual first aid kits, which is like the kits that you would wear into the theater. Each soldier would have one. And all of this stuff is really easily obtained via Amazon or a sporting store, and they're relatively cheap. A tourniquet goes anywhere from $6 to, you know, $20 for a fancy one, but these guys don't need super fancy stuff right now. Hopefully they don't need all the stuff that we're giving them.
But. Yeah, I agree with you there. How long will you be collecting these supplies, Taylor?
We're going to run this for about another 10 days. We've gotten a lot of citizens that have been dropping stuff off at my door. They've been scheduling with me to drop off at the fire station. And then towards the end of this week, I'm kind of going around and picking up all the other material and gear from the surrounding departments and getting it all in one spot. And then we're going to see how many crates we need and get it out to New Jersey.
Mm. Now, if someone isn't close to West Burke, how can they support your efforts?
So they can have it delivered if they order it online. If they order a tourniquet or an MRE or a small field medical kit, they can have it delivered to my address. They can have it delivered to the fire station. I'll give you my number.
All right.
And people can contact me that way. My number is out for public anyways in my business. So that's not a big deal.
All right. And
but other than that, yeah, we can set up and coordinate a pickup, or you can just have them send it right to my PO box.
All right. Give us your phone number, Taylor.
It's 802-535-0825.
All right. 535-0825. If you'd like to ask Taylor about what is needed or like to coordinate getting some of the supplies to Taylor, you can do that. You can also order online, have it delivered right to the West Burke Fire Station. You'll be able to find that online. Now, you said everything's going to go to New Jersey. So is there some kind of contact in Ukraine where this will be received? There's someone coordinating this here stateside? How's that being done?
Yeah, so in the process of trying to figure out how I could get all this out there, I talked to Senator Joe Benning and several others. It created a very long list of people I've had to call and,
of course,
get messages from to find out how to get it there. But once we figured it out, I talked to the NGO who was on her way back from Poland, and she said that there is a I believe it's a Slavic transportation agency that's kind of global, and they have an outfit in New Jersey. And they will take anything that is humanitarian-related for Ukraine for free. So just getting it there was the fight, really.
Right. And, Taylor, I mean, this is a beautiful thing you're doing, but why did you feel that this is what you needed to do?
Well, in today's day and age, we are privy to what's going on live. We're seeing, you know, a whole lot more live coverage of what's happening than we were in previous wars or conflicts. And, you know, I first felt compassion for the firefighters in the beginning stages when I saw them, and then, you know, just the people fleeing and then the people returning to fight. It's very admirable. It's awe-inspiring and just very I respect it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, you know, short of going over there myself, which probably wouldn't make my wife and kids too happy, I needed to do something. So I picked an avenue. You know, I didn't think sending a bunch of ammunition and firearms over there would probably be very easy. Plus, I didn't have all that. So I thought, you know, what do I have? And fire department was the first thing I thought of, seeing the firefighters there struggling. And, you know, I'm sure they're grabbing people for volunteers there just like we do here.
Yeah. So tell people again what fire departments can donate, what individuals can donate, how they reach you, where they can have it sent.
Okay. You have my number, 802-535-0825. If you're a fire department and you want to contribute, reach out to me. We'll organize a pickup. We're looking for any type of material that you guys have, gear, turnouts, bunker gear, hard hats, helmets, even construction hats, goggles, gloves, all that type of PPE, any old tools that, you know, I've seen better days, but still are efficient work tools, we'll take them. And then civilians, we are looking for the meals ready to eat or the non-perishable dry goods, no cans, nothing heavy. Camping food works really well. They have it at Walmart in the camping area. As well, they have tourniquets at Walmart as well. You guys can order on Amazon for the tourniquets, MREs, and the IFACs, which are IFAKs, which are individual first aid kits. Those are easily obtained on Amazon as well. And they're all pretty, like I said, they're all relatively inexpensive. The IFAC packs themselves are like $25. And that's probably the most expensive thing on there. So.
Wonderful.
If anybody wants to donate, we are definitely more than happy to take it and get it out there.
Taylor, this is fantastic. Taylor Payton is a volunteer firefighter in West Burke. Again, his number, 802-535-0825. Thanks so much for what you're doing, Taylor.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We have just a few more minutes left before the end of the show. So I'll probably squeeze in a little bit of haiku information. As a matter of fact, I'm sure we're going to have open phones at some point through the end of the week. So start writing some haiku that you can share with us later in the week. I do want to pass along that information again, that Taylor Payton, the volunteer firefighter in West Burke, collecting all that equipment. You can help with like individual first aid kits, tourniquets, different things. If you order online, you could have it delivered right to the West Burke Fire Station if you're somewhere outside the West Burke area, or you can just drop it off over there. You can coordinate with Taylor, find out what they need, how to get it, things to him, 802-535-0825. What a great effort. All right. Weybridge's fourth annual haiku contest was held recently, and they asked Vermonters to reflect on our challenging times. 28 writers submitted 217 haiku that range from traditional themes, Japanese-like contemplations of nature, all the way to contemporary concerns like COVID stress, mud season, and Ukraine. And like previous competitions, there were 6 formal winners, but everyone was recognized with a playful and sometimes serious Best of Award. And novelist Chris Bojelian was one of the 3 judges. He was the person who had to come up with the creative categories. So there were things like most astute summation of mud season and the natural world. The Alliteration is Awesome Award, things like that. This contest began in 2018, and we had some of the judges on last year. The contest was originally limited to Weybridge residents, which is home to Monument Dairy, great local dairy for milk and cheese, et cetera. And so 9 writers originally submitted 70 haiku that first year. So it certainly has climbed since then. All right. The very best haiku for a Vermont winner was Betty Barnes and she, of Montpelier. She also got the We Had All the Feels medal. And here it goes. All we have is here from one morning to the next. This can be enough. The second place winner was from Middlebury, Jack Mayer. Now, Jack Mayer is a doctor, I think a pediatrician, and wrote a wonderful book called Life in a Jar. If you ever want to learn about one of those unsung heroes of World War II, it's about Irena Sendler, who helped get something like 2,000 children out of the Warsaw Ghetto and to safety with families. Really phenomenal that Dr. Jack Mayer has written. But here's his. One crocus in snow warms more than a meadow full of summer flowers. I think that's beautiful. He is a great author and apparently a great haiku writer as well. The Weybridge winner was Gwen Nagy Benson. She also won the most astute summation of mud season in the natural world. And here it is. Crusted winter grime conceals the plate, but the car's clearly from Vermont. That resonates with me. I was just down in Mass. My car was covered in grime, in dirt, and you could not read the rear license plate. I think we're all familiar with that going on here in Vermont right now. Here's one. This won the Snow Falling from Beech Trees Award. It's Matthew Witten from Starksboro, who is working on a podcast that we hope to have here on the show sometime soon about Lake Champlain. And Matthew wrote this. Why does the beech tree hang onto its leaves so long? So we hear snowfall. Well done, Matthew. Again, if you want to write a haiku, 575. So 3 lines, 5 syllables in the first, 7 in the second, 5 in the third. And I think people do, change that up. I think you can go 797 if you'd want. But the traditional is 575 in 3 lines. Fran Putnam from Weybridge, won the Writing in the Snow Award. Patterns on the snow, rabbits, deer, mice, coyotes, leave their tracks behind. Probably was inspired by just looking out her window and seeing just that. Let's see. We have time for a few more here. The Pandemic in a Nutshell Award, Jill Dunn from Salisbury. Year 1, slow the spread. Year 2, a vaccination. Year 3, normalcy. Yeah, let's hope, Jill. I hope you're spot on. Well done. The Constellation at Night Award, won by Patty Laban Erb of Middlebury. Tonight we look up. We are a constellation, hand in hand in love. It's one of those that you say, ah. All right, one more. Let's try to get 2 in quick. The Best Use of Litany, Elizabeth von Buskirk Shelburne. On Breathless Nights, moths appear, foxes, bobcats, deer, one last unicorn. And the best used of litany non-unicorn version went to Kathleen McKinley Harris of Cornwall, scarlet cardinals, green rose females, fly among azure blue jay band. All right. We'll probably get into haiku later this week. So start writing some up. Have fun with it. And we'll see what we do. All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. And please feel free to suggest topics or guests by emailing us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to our podcast at wdevradio.com, which is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Bill Sayre up next with Common Sense Radio, and then Red Sox baseball beginning at 12:10. First pitch at 1:10. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk about Harleys. It's going to be very interesting, and solar energy issues.